Thank you so much for coming. I cannot tell you how honored I am to be here. There is no contemporary writer that means more to me than Larry Levis. There is no writer that I dip back into more than Larry Levis. There's probably no writer that I steal more from than Larry Levis. It means a tremendous amount to me to be here. So many thanks to VCU for everyone that's facilitated my visit here, and thanks to you for coming. I'll read a number of poems from the book, and then I'll also read a couple of new poems, I think, too. So I'll start with what is more or less the title poem of the collection. It takes as its starting point one of those old, beautiful, illuminated manuscripts that are rendered on a page of vellum, which, of course, is parchment made from animal skin. And then this poem is also a meditation on the knife as a source of both violence and beauty. This is called St. Catherine in an O, a song about knives. On a page of vellum, St. Catherine in an O, within a letter made of vine sprawl, imbricate bulbs, and the scarlet interlaced whorl of petal, cupping calyx, cupping stem, a woman offers her neck. It's a kind of ready-made scene. The saint kneeling on a cropped wedge of earth, someone with a crown in a tower, and a swordsman who is only a frocked booted boy pulling back his robe for his work, and seems carelessly done, as if the illuminator chose death to be a kind of afterthought to vermilion, to leaf curl, areola, all shaped stems, his blossoms, dazzling tangle. As if this were response enough. O, omphalos, meaning center and navel, meaning the first time a blade touches flesh, and meaning here a frame of plenitude through which we witness again. There are no limits to our verbs, our forms. Think of the knife that slits an orange or bundled iris stems, the one strapped to the rooster's varnished spur, the dagger, poniard, dirk, edge that snips the line, whittles an owl, julienne's, traces a lip, a cut, an incision, a gouge. In Sudan, the story goes, when the slogan of reform was, the future's in your hands, men scavenged the streets, waving machetes, hacking off hands above the wrist, asking, how will you hold the future now? The stiletto, the skein, the scythe, the choosing, the mark, the tool. Beneath a concrete bridge, shirtless and drunk, a boy works his way through the swallow's nest, slashing until each mud cone shape drops into the river, dissolves. Yet to say so is hardly enough. To say pig sticker, bayonet, shiv. Because in Waco, behind Benny's Gas and Go, a man plays slide guitar with his pocket knife, accompanying the words of his songs. One about light, the Lord moving on water, about what will be by and by, how blood he knows will make him whole and blades that changed into doves. Or because the splendor of color ends on the parchment in a burnished gold resembling a cluster of burrs, the kind of thing that would have snagged in a cow's mottled hide as it grazed on grass tufts, or slogged its way home. Staring, bewildered, in the stillness, it may survive this way for a few days more before it is bled and flayed and turned, as was always its purpose, into the page of this psalm. Here, near the margin, are traces of it still. Patterns of skin, a texture like velvet, follicles, the throat's scalloped curve. Montezuma's painters. Fly swats and muddied cloaks, slop buckets and greyhound tongues. From behind the grasses they watched, and on bark paper strips and henequen cloth rendered what they saw. Torn linen bandaging a thigh, and their black beards, their anchored ships, the wooden crates of quail. For this is what he had asked. Buckles, cups made of Florentine glass, hide stitched into wine-heavy sacks. And while some carried maize cakes, baked fish, and plums, the images were rushed back inland to him. Crossbows, the cannons, inlaid brass, tattered pennants, each length of pearls, so that he, too, might see these men and the shapes of all they had brought. Their crimson caps, muskets, hammered bronze, tassels, scabbards, and blades. Each thing seemed just as it should. Each particular was beautifully faithful to itself. The details were lavish, exact. Half greaves and backplates catching midday sun, ash-colored horse tethered to a palm, and their uses still unimaginable. The next poem centers on John Keats's last days. He traveled to Italy knowing he was dying, and he traveled with his friend and the artist Joseph Severin, who did a number of drawings along the way. And I think one of the things for me that's most moving about those last letters of Keats is there's a kind of expansive rapture, an expansive sense of beauty that you can see in those last gestures, even as he knows that his life is closing down and coming to an end. He studied as a medical student before he was a poet, and he knew, as he said, that death was very imminent. And this poem uses as sources the drawings of Severin and also letters written by Keats, quoted from Severin here too. This is called Those Two Sketches by Severin in Italy. One, the one that no longer survives, is only of moonlight in Naples Bay, widening, glistening in a chalk-colored sheet, and was a stand-in for the splendor of quarantine. 10 days skittering with mast stems and rigs, the wings of seabirds, and watching, stuffed with beef tongue, figs, and peaches, hawkers, moorings, Vesuvius in haze, fishermen hauling in the inexhaustible anchovy-like fish that from a distance was a silver writhing. Because he had made already ink-dipped stroke by stroke, at least a single thing he saw pure. The look of black water suddenly aflame. There was no need, perhaps, to render their vertura creeping towards Rome, how he heaped Keats flat on his back with wildflowers, thistle, cyclamen, and shrubby pimpernel, those lavender petals neither one could name. Or the heaps of water buffalo grazing the hills, the lichen-covered rocks of aqueducts, roadside myrtle, orange groves and gibbets, the sun-bleached severed arms of bandits. Because moonlight was plenitude enough. And the other, that sketch of Keats's face, adrift, sweat-slick, unshaved, done by oil lamp to stay awake, is enough too of what Severn at last was made to admit, the rumpled locks plastered to that forehead, that dark, unreadable, amorphous shape rising moon-like from behind his cheek, and the sparse lines sprawling down from his neck that mean, I know, his breath in the dark, but look like movement in water, a current, a river, the churning sea, something like the storm that hatched off Brighton when their cabin flooded from a leak in the planks, and in the slosh of gear squashing below, Severin quipped, here's pretty music for you. And the song was only the pailsful. Waves, he wrote, and mountains. This sketch, too, is those last months paired, distilled, and means what seemed unending, hours of fawn-covered phlegm, the candlelit pages of holy dying, and afterwards, that bonfire at the Spanish Steps after Signora Angeletti orders the entire room burned. Beds, sheets, windows, doors, even the bits of wallpaper, varnish scraped from the floor, the ceilings painted gold rosettes, and how from all those gathered things the flames will lift, grow, and the ash will fall on the branches, the stone benches and stones, and settle in the fountain that is Bernini's waterlogged boat, sunk to its gunwale's fleshy curves, where water spills, pours perpetually from its sides with a sound that means abundance, drowning. I had the really good fortune of studying with an amazing music teacher that I met even when I was 14, and this poem in the book is dedicated to him, William Appling. I just learned a few weeks ago that he passed away. He was an enormous influence on my life, and he introduced me at the time, kind of begrudgingly, to the music of Brahms and Schubert. He also sat me down and made me listen to John Coltrane for the first time. He had me listen to Charles Mingus for the first time, which, you know, for a freshman in high school, it was a mind-blowing experience. And I think much to his disappointment, it also led me to a lot of really raunchy tenor wild R&B songs as well that I still have a lifelong passion for. This poem is a meditation on one of those songs. It also swerves into Sonny Liston's early and violent life, but especially because this poem is dedicated in the book to him, I wanted to read this tonight for William Appling. I feel as if he taught me how to listen to music. Night Train, A Listener's Guide. Jimmy Forrest, sax man in the band, stands back row. Tipped the tenor's bell, let his spit puddle out, and knew, just months with Duke Ellington's band, he would pawn off this riff as his own. He knew the sugared image that inspired the song, happy-go-lucky local, and thought, fuck the fireman, the grin and nod, clang of a single bell. What he wanted was glassy-eyed, raw, a growl, a spur line plowing Kansas City night, battered, sputtering, a staccato wail, craving anything within earshot. What he wanted would be Sonny Liston's song of choice, shadowboxing, devouring the bag, or even closer, the champ years before. How he made in St. Louis a rumbling of the night, jumping packing plant workers staggering home, arm-locked couples interrupted mid-laugh, the dockhand watching the diner sign flash between red and black. Between coal and car on Biddle Street, face broiled with ale, Liston whips grit into the shop owner's eyes, swats him down blinded with a single blow, kicks only twice when the body stills, and finds nine ones in his sock. Listen, even closer, the man's telling the tale, crumpled, reeking of sweat. He's trying again, stammering now, fumbling to get everything right, and the cop's mind is on gas bills and last night's game as he writes overalls, 10:45, and pencils in next to means of attack, dirt, fist, feet. I'm gonna read a two-part poem, reading some new work. The poem is called Audubon Diptych, and the first part takes a moment from Audubon's journals that is meditated upon and also begins with a series of legends and myths associated with swallows. And the second part is borrowed from a biography from Richard Rhodes a number of years ago. He wrote about Audubon, and among many other things, one thing he captures so well are Audubon's kind of early awkward years where he's fumbling after his technique, where he is still trying to rarefy how it was that he was going to bring these birds alive on the page. And I have to say, at least in my work, those are the artists I'm most drawn to, where they are hard-earned moments of grace versus someone like Mozart, who seemed to be writing operas and sonatas at the age of like 1.5, and the effortless nature of that. So the second part interweaves those kind of what I think of as really wonderful failings with one of Ovid's creation stories. Audubon Diptych. One, wherein the swallows instruct us in pleasure. Because they daubed with poppy sap the stricken eyes of their young, and because each thin body, it was believed, contained a bright red stone that could honey the word-addled tongue, balm the frenzied brain, they were restorers, the ancients taught, and were the restored, too. Since year after year, farmers observed them just after the autumn frost plummet single file like a bead of pearls into lakes where they remained submerged until spring, when they'd wing back in dripping columns. All of which is no less improbable than Audubon's account of the slate-green birds pouring into a sycamore trunk like bees hurrying into their hive. The thunder of wings and that slow inhalation, for the tree seemed to breathe in bird upon bird, was first matched by thunder building behind the silver hills, and then was paired, once he pressed his ear to the bark, with the delicate clamor and scratch of each one inching through the hollow. Those wings, he imagined, by my lantern's light, and until his light possessed them, what use to see them merely thread the air? What use were the half-done sketches of his flycatcher, grouse, that for now unworkable clapper-rail beak, and hearing, instead of their ravishing wing-frenzied stream, jam jars rattling on the boil? Thus, a hired woodsman pries back the bark and allows him one night to burrow in. Who wouldn't want this, too? To stand within the tree's 8-foot trunk and gaze upon them teeming in rows, to reach into, as he did, the crushed quill mat and pluck them from sleep and kill, soundlessly, with a kind of care, as many as he could carry. Closing the entrance, Audubon concludes, we march towards Louisville perfectly elated. And despite where his story is hard to believe, no one doubts this joy. For what could have been lacking that journey home? There was the road's moonlit moss-webbed oak, seen as if for the first time. And here, in his pockets, filled to bursting, the slender, still warm forms. 2. Resurrection in the Common Merganser. Before he could restore even one part, tail plunge, talon tips sunk into catfish flesh, and whatever it is that makes his warbler weightless on the azalea stem, Audubon invariably failed to make, as was always his plan, the watercolor's stippled touch return the quick breaths of each bird. He tried first with a pigeon slung against a barn door, but even if he managed its burnt orange throat, he could only render it as it was before him, gangly in a one-legged splay. And before he pummeled it to pieces, humbled, irate, he tried to build a universal bird, a mannequin of cork and narrow wooden stumps, barely reminiscent of wings, let alone a kind of flight. But life, he believed, could be brush-stroked back, and he blundered towards nimbler forms. Essicus, hidden within another story, can no longer watch river water pearl on Hesperia's skin, and so pursues her lust-driven through the fields and woods until death reaches for her ankle in the slender form of a snake. Only then do his desires change, and when he flings himself, guilt-stricken, headlong from the cliff, a god, as the gods will rarely do, denies him the privilege of death. This time, Ovid tells us, the body doesn't change in a whirlwind fit, but rather, as Essicus plunges down towards the waves, feathers pierce his skin. Before long, he'll become the first merganser. The same crested fish-diving duck Audubon clips almost daily from the Mississippi's iced-over banks. Of one, he notes its triangular tongue, the 9-inch bottom feeder lodged in its gut, that its legs were, as usual, the color of sealing wax, and then begins to rekindle its life through the method by then he'd learned. First, impale with wire the sun-dried wings, its mandible and mottled breast, attach it to a plank with a backdrop grid, and mold it to a lifelike pose. Odd how in the watercolors for the birds of America, we're missing the engraver's final work. The river is just a few light blue strokes, and instead of an intricate tangle of grass, a merganser soars through an empty page. Essicus, for a while, isn't finished either, though he will be soon. Even as he thrashes in his rage and grief, not quite bird or man, he can feel it, the lure of it beginning, and his beginning to be hollow bones. What else can he do but unburden himself, give himself over to the body's suppleness, its impossible glistening, the grace afforded after all? I read a couple new poems. Here's another poem about an artist in kind of a creative purgatory. John Singer Sargent, of course, is an artist known most for his portrait work, and then he also was commissioned late in his life and late in World War I to be a war artist by the British government. And I think what drew me to this part of Sargent's biography was this convergence of the world of that iconographic Madame X portrait with the scandalous black gown dress strap hanging over her shoulder, that juxtaposition with the real horrors of World War I. And most of this poem kind of centers on Sargent's uncertainty as an artist about how he's going to render this material, what he's actually witnessing in the war. And the premise of the poem also pivots on a direct address to Vulcan, the Roman blacksmith god. And the reasons for that, I think, will be clear when I read the epigraph, in which Sargent, rather oddly, given the circumstances, links his failure as an artist to render this subject matter to the famous myth of Vulcan composing and creating, rather, the net where he ensnares his unfaithful wife and her lover on his own couch by God. I'll read the epigraph first, and then I'll read the poem. This is Sargent adrift at the trenches. The naked eye cannot catch it, nor have I, so far, forged the Vulcan's net in which the act can be imprisoned and looked gaily upon. How can there be anything flagrant enough for a picture when Mars and Venus are miles apart, whether in camps or in the front trenches? John Singer Sargent, 1918. God of the bellows and black clouds of making, cuckold, slow one, bearer of light and fire's rage, forger of armor which shines, Virgil tells us, like sapphire clouds backlit by sun, in the intricate shield Aeneas could not stop gazing upon, tracing on its hammered bronze, the minutiae of battle, blood-wet briars, moon-glint of spears, and all of the work of men. Even if, after years of silence, you're summoned up again as war slogs on, know this is floundering more than praise. This is a man reduced to allegorizing love and war, despite the khaki-teeming tents of Arras, a place before now he knew only for the tapestries burned in the wake of the Bastille, for the gold threads woven in, and how the Met housed one that survived, with its warp and weft of wind-blown oaks, clustering ferns, Gabriel's tumbling jade-green sleeves, and the ruby-crowned virgin interrupted from her work, from her book, regarding the angel blankly, as if baffled by this unexpected task. Just as Sergeant, tongue-tied, wanders bomb-gouged streets, watching soldiers lounge against whatever hasn't yet collapsed, or the flood of light in a cathedral's ruin. Some days, in truth, he only half seeks the muse, meandering instead to a creek where the men bathe, doze, sun-dry their bodies of such blinding gleam. He keeps their flesh empty on the page, affording them shape through a fretwork of grass and cattail streaking thigh and chest, a shadow-scribbled lushness many worlds away from the wire-strewn fields, as if these watercolors were dashed out the summer before, when he inhaled Florida's palmettos, tawny lagoons, the dappled mud-glistening alligator backs, when not bored by yet more hired portrait work and the white pleats of Rockefeller's pants. Gun glint in a trench, lumbering convoys, a sugar factory's remains, to Tommy's filching sun-warmed cherries. For 2 months, he's been dabbling en plein air, lost in the sea of his commission, stymied by the 9x20 epic he needs to lure, as he put it, into your lace-like net. Castaway, crippled one, lord of all bright hissing steel, these words are not meant as invocation, unless prayer means the way we limp towards form. I have seen what I wanted, Sergeant writes at last, and on sight begins to sketch the line of gassed, blindfolded men. Helmet straps, boots, a canteen tipped back, each crease of each face nodding cloth, and eye-seared soldiers processing across what will be a pale ochre sky. And even now, grouped on the page in tercet like threes, even now, spaced as orderly as the lavish binding mesh made by a god long dead. I also have been thinking about the vortex of history. Randy Mandy's lame-ass allegory of history, a corrective. 1986, our middle school AC on the fritz, and the sheer bliss of summer stalled in the offing as Randy Mr. Mandy fills the year-end history hole with whatever films crop up. One day, a heat-warped Disney montage of insects scrapping in the desert, and Thursday is a fast-forward blur through the Ten Commandments' technicolor plagues in order to reach, before the bell, Heston in a paste-on beard bellowing, "Behold his mighty hand," while the Red Sea rips into kitschy, thundering columns. For a week, as we doodled, spitballed red porn or palms, and the lucky drifted like fresh smoke to the make-out back row, he sank deeper into his mug and let the televised commission roll with its too late jabber about warped O-rings and flashback footage again and again of the space shuttle disappearing into flame, leaving behind nothing but that knotted plume which coiled in the Florida sky and moved for a long time nowhere. "Our century's greatest disaster," Mandy declared, eyes glued to Debbie G's ornsicle splotched chest. And on the day I sent my scribbled plea to Nikki Drobnik, she of the knee scabs, bleached curls, and a single night-haunting spit-wet spin-the-bottle kiss, we half watched the scurrying black and white prep work for the Bikini Island nuclear test. And the long pause before it reached her, the note read and passed hand by hand, Men thatched the newly christened stud saloon, stalked control group low-tide eels, smeared with sunblock the sailor-suited pigs to be tethered aboard the ghost fleet. And some guy took his sweet, sweet time painting the deluge of Rita Hayworth's hair onto the bomb dubbed Gilda in tribute to her one-glove Buenos Aires striptease. My sweat couldn't stop by the time a commander squatted among the mise-en-scene palms for the second take of trawling Exodus to explain why the Bikinians should load up and float across miles of sea. A chance to glimpse God's hand and something like his pillar of smoke, only more effective. Hey, Mandy, remember that ham-fisted laminated allegory of history taped to your wired mesh glass, its scrolls and braided scribes, that hovering sun-warped angel puckering a slender trumpet? Not that it matters, not that you're listening, but the real tableau is here, the lot of us, dazed, bored, lit by the tree-shaped mile-high blast when it comes, like Niagara in reverse, like a world forming before our eyes, as Nikki turns in what looks like horror, just the slow mouth, no. I'll just end with one last short poem. Charlie Chaplin had a really odd coda to his life. He was a victim of a grave robbing, and two Eastern European mechanics stole his body with the plan of selling it back to the family in the hopes of getting a garage that they dreamed of. And they botched it really horribly, the whole crime. It was described like a Keystone Cops caper. But for a small period of time, the body was held in a field in the south of France. And one of the lovely things about this story, I couldn't get this into the poem, but Chaplin's widow, after the body was restored and returned to the gravesite, she would always return to that field as a place of remembering her husband. That, for her, held much more resonance, that spot, than the actual grave marking. And this is a story, I remember hearing this or reading this at some point, and I had it in my head for years, not sure how I was going to use it, not sure how I was going to employ it, but wanting to get it somehow. And I realized after a while that it's a story of resurrection and the hope for an afterlife. I mean, to die and end up in the south of France, even for a few days, seems like a pretty good deal. And maybe the most we can hope for. Charlie Chaplin, Dug Up and Ransomed, a prayer. That my body, Lord, might rise too, resurrected reluctantly from earth. Given the rainwater, the dawn begun, grave walls pitched into ooze. Given that the scheme to bury me deeper in my own grave's dirt will fail because of schnapps and mud. And Lord, let the breath of those who deliver me that night be sweetened by cherry-tipped cigars. Allow what will lift me, fumbling, the first march of my death to be not only a shovel, the grace of rope, a mechanic's coat trussed to brass handles, but also the plan for a paid-for garage, paved cement floors, a procession of wrenches in a drawer. Grant me morning light in a pickup bed, line with an earshot of Bulgarian songs that rhyme thigh with smoke, and permit me, Lord, once hangovers wane, to be stashed at the far edge of a field, close to the rocks of a fishing spot, where a thief will always, or for more than a week, watch me, conceal me, keep me in spring heat, devour a plum and suck its pit clean, dream of cash he half knows won't come. Let my reward, Lord, be crow wings, furrows, bits of last year's stalks, three threadbare burlap sacks. Thank you very much. Thank you for coming.